This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Jeff Bezos is going to fix it. On his way to Mars. I think he's interested in space travel too, right? So if you're going to go into space, you probably need some good reading material while you're going. Of course, he has a Kindle, I bet.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Jeff Bezos of education policy, Dara Z. Handler.
Oh, I wish I had that kind of disposable income.
Well, you're not worth $25 billion like he is, but some people see you as the savior of our industry. In our case, the education policy think tank industry.
And I would like to know who those people are and set the record straight.
Yes, very good. So, this is interesting. The press love writing about themselves, and so not surprisingly, this has been a big story in newspapers this week. But what do you think? I mean, I guess it is a pretty big deal, Washington Post selling itself to Jeff Bezos.
I think people are just delighting in the irony that someone who has made many of those millions off of Kindle is now buying a print newspaper.
Yeah, exactly. And you could say that the internet has destroyed newspapers, and now will it be its salvation? We'll see. I have to say, as a now longtime Washingtonian, I think I'm at something like 15 years, the Post really sucks compared to what it used to be. I mean, it used to be a great paper that you'd look forward to reading, and now it's just pretty lame.
As long as they don't do away with the Express, I'll be happy. It is the perfect length of the train ride on the way to work.
That's part of the problem. Now, I guess I see.
It's better than not reading at all.
No, I see your point. Look, at least there for a while, the Washington Post editorial page, the op-eds were great. There's still a handful, but they've gotten worse. So, hey, bring it on, Jeff Bezos. We need to shake it up.
Yeah, but with the internet and everyone having a blog, who reads the op-eds in the paper anymore?
Yeah, I do. I aspire.
Who else?
That's my dream, to be the next David Brooks. That's my dream.
I'd like to have enough money to buy a newspaper.
Okay, so lots to talk about because, we say this all the time. You'd always think that the things would slow down in the summer, but it doesn't happen anymore. The education news just keeps on going. So, Pamela, let's do it. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
On Wednesday, education officials confirmed that, as expected, New York students fared worse on the state's tough new Common Core aligned tests than they did on last year's tests. Critics of Mayor Bloomberg have latched onto the numbers, pointing to the lower test scores as evidence of the failure of Bloomberg's education reforms. Is that the lesson we should draw?
Darren?
I don't know. What I think about this is it's a very weird issue of a mandate. Education has become a mandate on mayors. So we saw this in D.C. when Adrian Fenty basically got voted out of office because of his backing on Michelle Rhee. Now Mayor Bloomberg is New York City, but we're talking about New York State tests. Mayors have picked this up, and it's voluntary, but how much does a mayor really have to do with test scores?
Well, now hold on. In New York City, he has had control of the schools for almost a dozen years. I think what's tricky is that Mayor Bloomberg, and let's face it, Joel Klein before him, made a big deal about increases in test scores on the old test and to try to make the case that the schools in New York were getting significantly better. They were closing the gap with the rest of the state. And of course, there's been big debate on this. And you look at the NAEP scores in New York, and depending on which year you start with, etc., you don't find that much progress happening in New York City over time. A little bit here and there. Some progress on graduation rates, big progress. But on test scores, it's been pretty lame. So, look, I don't think these new scores should be used to bash Mayor Bloomberg, or they can't be used to really say, how are the schools doing? I mean, it's a new baseline. At the same time, I think it is fair to say that it raises questions about the earlier celebrations of progress under the Bloomberg regime.
Well, they had a baseline to go on, so it was a progress when they were using the same state tests for a couple of years, and you say, oh, test scores went up, and then you actually do have a baseline. Yeah. I mean, I think this is something that we're going to be seeing pretty much everywhere, that students aren't performing as well as they were, or perhaps as well as expected, and what are we going to do about it?
Now, so one of the big stories here is likely, because you just do the math, you're going to see achievement gaps get worse, right? Because at the proficiency level, if you set the bar low enough, almost everybody gets over it, and you say, oh, we have a very small achievement gap, at least a small proficiency achievement gap. You set the bar much higher, most of the white kids get over it, most of the minority kids do not, suddenly you have a huge achievement gap. So what, one thing that'll be interesting to see is whether these miracle schools, like some of the great charter schools that have been celebrated, still looks good against these higher standards. My understanding is that some, like Democracy Prep, do not. Others, like the Success Academies, still look phenomenal. So this is going to be another interesting story that, you know, how do schools look against a tougher standard?
And as a tangent, I know this has been brought up before, but one of the things that I worry about is what does it do to a kid when this student has previously been proficient on whatever test that they're taking, and now all of a sudden they drop 20 percentiles? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Look, I'd rather tell the kid when they're in fourth grade than when they're in 12th grade, or when they're ending up in remedial education. And they're like, what? I've been told that I've been doing great for 13 years.
Honesty is the best policy.
Thank you. All right. As Dave Driscoll's writing about in the New York Post, I believe New Yorkers can handle the truth. Okay, topic number two.
Following the Tony Bennett flap, the A through F school grading systems Bennett championed are under the gun. What can we expect the ramifications to be?
You know, I hope that there are ramifications. I hope this leads to a real conversation about how to appropriately measure school success or failure. I am still a fan of A to F systems and that they present information that parents can understand, but I'm not totally sold on the idea that it has to be just one grade. I think you could have one grade for proficiency rates, for example, and another grade for growth, or one grade for low-achieving kids and another grade for high-achieving kids, or one for math, or one for reading. And I don't know that it has to be just one. But I also hope we get under the hood here and talk about what these systems are measuring and whether we're measuring the right things.
I mean, I think that there is a incredibly difficult trade-off between accessibility of information and nuance of information. Right. That an A to F grade is really easy for parents or anybody to understand. It's a scale that they are used to for their entire lives, but it's one grade. Well, then what happens when you break it down into multiple grades and you bring in more information and you have all kinds of asterisks and footnotes about how it's measured? And what happens, for example, if a school doesn't have a 12th grade, but they're still a high school, how do you calculate their graduation rate? You've caveat after caveat, and now all of a sudden you sacrificed simplicity for having 8 pages of grades and footnotes.
Can I point out the irony of you talking like this, Dara? I love this because Dara and Amber are the ones constantly putting in footnotes, going into nuanced details, and I'm the one trying to take them out.
Yes, because we don't talk to parents.
yes. Okay. But yes. And then what? Maybe you have what? Higher standards for our readers than I do. I'm like, nobody cares about this level of detail, people.
We care about the level of detail. We will just put it in the appendix for you.
No, but you're totally right. But here's the question. Look, parents are used to getting a report card for their kids. And if their kids are taking 5 or 6 or 7 different subjects, that means 5 or 6 or 7 different grades. So right. I think they could handle, let's say, 5 grades.
But on their math, a student gets a math grade, but it doesn't give them a grade for adding and subtracting and then multiplying and making graphs and whatever else, you know, these other math skills. It's not broken down quite that far.
That's right. So I'm just saying, hey, instead of one grade, maybe 5 grades.
I think you should pass that information along, but maybe not to Tony Bennett anymore.
Ah, poor Tony Bennett. Okay, topic number three.
In a Washington Post op-ed, Robert Samuelson argued that the fiscal crisis facing state and local governments can be boiled down to the clash of two interests, schools versus nursing homes. What does he mean?
And which ones do you favor, dear?
That is a loaded question if I ever heard one. I mean, what he's saying, right, is are you taking care? What is your primary responsibility? Is it to the youngest generation or the oldest? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that this is a new issue that he's bringing up. We live in a time of scarcity of resources. And even when we haven't been in a recession or recovering from one, there never is enough public money to do everything that we want to do. So I don't think that this is a new issue, although it's certainly eye-grabbing way of phrasing it.
But look, he talks about that there are real pension problems here. We're seeing Illinois is blowing up over their pension issue right now. Their bond rating is going down. We have done some studies. You have shepherded, Dara, about the pension crisis, and we've been looking at it within schools. So here it's not schools versus nursing homes. It's, you know, one, it's classrooms, basically, versus retiree expenses. And it's tricky. Look, we don't want to throw grandmom, who spent 35 years teaching the classroom, under the bus. At the same time, we need to do a good job providing good education for the kids today and tomorrow. And it's hard to figure out how to make all that add up.
I think in this, what is critical that people realize is that we're talking about, for retirees, there are two types of costs. There is the debt that is already owed to people who have retired, and we can't do anything about that other than pay it. And then there is the future debt that is being accrued by teachers who are currently teaching right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that what has consistently been misrepresented is that we're not taking pension reforms, don't take pension benefits away from teachers that have already accrued them. These are, it's a debt that is owed to them, and the state is going to have to figure out how to pay
for
that.
Unless somebody goes bankrupt.
Unless, like, that Detroit is true. Right. That's true. I will add that caveat. But then when we're talking about reform, we're talking about avoiding future debt and perhaps mitigating some of these unwise decisions that states have made in the past.
Look, and where the real savings are, as we've seen from Wisconsin, that you can legitimately get to, it's the retiree health care. It's this question is, does it make sense to provide free or highly subsidized health insurance to teachers who retire at age 52 or 55 until they turn 65 and get Medicare. And, you know, I think there's a case to be made that says, look, they may not want to keep teaching, but they're still young enough to be doing some job where they could be getting benefits, or they can now buy into the new Obamacare, whatever they're called. So, so the idea that school districts should continue to provide that kind of benefit, which is incredibly expensive, I think that's one that's really going to take a hit.
One last point, of course, as the researcher, I think that this speaks to the fact that we really, really need to understand total teacher compensation, not just talking about salaries, but how much are teachers really making in terms of deferred mm-hmm. benefits in order to have a really reasonable conversation about teacher compensation, pensions, and retiree health care.
And you will get the last word. Thank you very much. As I said, the Jeff Bezos of education policy. Thank you, Dara Z-Handler. It is now time for everyone's favorite segment, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Amber, do you agree with me that the Washington Post used to be great and now sucks?
I'm not a particular fan of the Post. I was very sad to see the alternative go away. I used to grab both the Express and the Why just blank on the name?
Oh, the Examiner.
The Examiner. And now I can only grab
the Examiner.
One.
I didn't even know that. The Examiner went
gone,
away?
Done.
When did that happen?
Yeah, like two months ago.
They have really good
interesting
number puzzles in the back of the Examiner.
So, you know, it was nice to get both sides, but now you just get one.
Yes.
Around this town.
Well, so. Jeff Bezos is going to fix it. On his way to Mars. I think he's interested in space travel, too, right?
That's true. Not as much as Richard Branson, but...
If you're going to go into space, you probably need some good reading material while you're going.
Yes.
Of course, he has a Kindle, I bet. Okay, topic... What you got for us this week?
All right. We're tracking Common Core implementation. Everybody knows this. So I got to do the latest survey. So this is coming out of the Center on Ed Policy. They've got this long-term grant to do these surveys every year. This is year three of implementing the Common Core standards. 40 states replied. So, yeah, hey, that's pretty good. And 30 key findings. 30 states curriculum aligned to the Common Core is being implemented in both math and ELA, at least in some districts in some grade levels. As for full saturation, 9 states report implementing Common Core math throughout their K-12 system in school year 2012-2013. 2013. In ELA, the same is true for 12 states. So there are some states saying we're doing this whole hog. Most states are doing something to prepare teachers at this point. 37 say they're developing and disseminating PD materials and guides. 33 say they're working with higher ed institutions to align curriculum content and teacher prep programs. 30 say they're sponsoring initiatives to help low-performing schools transition to the Common Core. A dozen say they've had cuts or freezes in education, but they're still, you know, trying to do what they can. But six admit that they've reduced their technology expenditures related to Common Core assessments. 26 states report it's difficult to identify or develop curriculum materials necessary to implement the core. 32 say the same for principal and teacher evaluation systems. And finally, 27 say they have the staff expertise at the State Department to support state implementation of the Common Core. Mm-hmm. Now, this was the only thing. Granted, this is self-report. It gets kind of bland. What can you make of these data? But the one little nugget I picked out. So 37 say they're developing and disseminating PD materials and guides, right? 36 say they're carrying out statewide PD. Mm-hmm. But yet a majority also report they're really struggling with developing and identifying curriculum materials. So what I'm finding, and this is what I saw when I went to Tennessee, frankly, is these states are rolling out PD and PD modules without the curriculum.
Right.
So, you know, you're kind of putting the cart before the horse. This is going to have implications.
So what are they teaching the teachers to do?
Well, in one state, they're talking about what the Common Core does. It's a shift, you know, the shift towards more text-based, evidence-based learning. I mean, they're talking about what the Common Core is in terms of its, I don't know, what do you want to call that, philosophy?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not...
The instructional shift.
Yes, but it's not curriculum.
Right. It's not, let's actually do the instructional shift.
Do the instruction.
And by the way, you know, they're having a hard time finding curricular materials. Let me give them some advice. www.coreknowledge.org.
Right.
It's right there, in my opinion, for English at least.
I don't know why. I mean, I feel like they're trying to recreate the wheel here.
Well, I wonder, though, how many, even before this, actually gave teachers the curriculum and instructional materials, and how many just gave them the standards and said, here, you figure it out.
Right.
Especially in non-core subjects in high school that are not taught in tested years.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I guess it's somewhat helpful, but I am quite skeptical of these kinds of self-reports. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you say, right? I mean, you got to go out there and you got to see what's happening. You got to look at the materials and you got to find out. And I think the expectation has got to be, look, it's going to be widely varied depending on the school district. But maybe some states are on it more than others. I mean, the state that's most on it, we think, is New York in terms of curriculum. Mm-hmm. And they're really working on building up elaborate curricular resources for the teachers. But it's not done yet.
It's not done yet. But they are, because, you know, we're including that in an upcoming study, a review of their materials. But they're working hard. I mean, yesterday there were four modules up at a particular grade level. Today there are six. I mean, they are, every day they're adding because they're under the gun to get this done. So they're working hard.
All right, good. Hey, look, at least we're talking about teaching and learning. You know,
we are.
I mean, how strange is that in this field that we are talking about actually teaching and learning what goes on inside the classroom? It's refreshing.
Yes. We're getting dirty.
Trickle down policy.
All right. Thanks, everybody. That's all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Darcy Handelar.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.